Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Quick reminder that when the George H.W. Bush funeral service begins, you can hear it live at WNYC.org. We'll be live streaming it if you'd like to listen. Now, at the holidays, as people think in the name of religion about sentiments like peace on earth and goodwill toward all, at least in theory, it's appropriate to take stock of the year in hate crimes based on religion, too. We talked on Monday about the rise in overt acts of anti-Semitism this year, and yesterday about the threats to Christians living in parts of the Middle East. As we turn today to anti-Muslim hate crimes, one thing to note is that attacks against Muslims and Jews seem to be rising together. The Pittsburgh synagogue massacre was in part an attack on Jews because a Jewish group, Hias, was helping to settle Muslim refugees, as one big example. A story in the Washington Post just yesterday about Canada noted a 47% rise in hate crimes there last year. Yes, even Canada has hate crimes. And more than 40% of those hate crimes in Canada were based on religion, overwhelmingly targeting Muslims and Jews. Hate crimes against blacks also spiked, and sometimes those crimes are intersectional when people are seen as both dark-skinned and Muslim. Back in this country, we're in a perilous period for being a Muslim in public or to be perceived as one. 2016, the year of Trump's election, was the only year that violent anti-Muslim hate crimes, as counted by the FBI and the Pew Research Center, surpassed 2001, the year of 9/11. That year, there were 91 documented assaults against Muslims. In 2016, there were 127. And last year, 2017, the latest for which stats are available, the FBI said hate crimes overall rose again. According to Pew, it's also important to remember that physical attacks are not the only kinds of hate crimes. Most common is intimidation, which is defined as reasonable fear of bodily harm. Anti-Muslim intimidation also increased in 2016, with 144 reported victims compared with 120 the previous year, says Pew. And here in New York City, the rise in hate crimes generally has prompted some city council members to propose the creation of a new city agency, an Office of Hate Crimes Prevention. Here's Councilmember Donovan Richards of Queens.
They've come for a synagogue. They've come for a church. They've come for mosque. They've come for our universities. They've come for our African burial ground. The message is, when will it stop?
Councilmember Donovan Richards of Queens, yesterday on the steps of City Hall. Yesterday also marked exactly 1 year since the Supreme Court allowed the Trump administration's partial Muslim entry ban to take effect. The ACLU reports that the overwhelming percentage of waiver applications allowed under the ban are being denied and that refugee admissions of Muslims are grinding toward a halt. The midterms saw the first two Muslim women ever elected to Congress, but appeals to anti-Muslim bias were also documented during a variety of campaigns. The Texas Observer reports that a county Republican party in Texas has scheduled a so-called training for later this month by someone the Observer calls an anti-Islam crackpot, just weeks before the party decides on whether to expel two of its members, one a Muslim and one the spouse of a Muslim. The so-called training will be called School, Sharia Law versus the U.S. Constitution, and according to the Observer, will be held in an undisclosed location for Republican Party officials and local police in Tarrant County. And a survey that came out in April from the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding indicated Muslim Americans are more likely than people in other religions to internalize negative stereotypes of their group, with media representations getting some of the blame. With us now is Rowaida Abdelaziz, a reporter at HuffPost, where she focuses on Islamophobia and social justice issues within the Muslim community. Rowaida, thanks so much for coming in. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
And there are lots of places we could start, but how about your reporting on the paradox during the midterm election campaign of the most Muslim candidates ever, but perhaps the most Islamophobic elections ever? Your article mentioned a report documenting dozens of candidates running on anti-Muslim platforms. Maybe you want to tell us about some of what that report found.
Yeah, absolutely. And so as many of us know, people have dubbed this last year as the blue wave. Within Muslim communities specifically, they've dubbed it as the Muslim blue wave. And the reason why is because there have been approximately 90 to 100 different Muslim candidates that were running for public offices nationwide. So this was huge in terms of representation. It was huge in terms of just the sheer number of Muslims running. So this was pretty much a big deal. Also, to give some perspective, there are about 3 million Muslims that reside here in the United States, but only two hold seats in Congress out of those 535 seats. There's only two. So the fact that so many Muslims were running was quite a big deal. But with the sheer amount of Muslims running for public office also came the backlash, came the anti-Muslim rhetoric and tons of Islamophobia. A study put out by Harvard a couple months ago documented five tactics that oftentimes these Muslim candidates had faced. Oftentimes they were accused of having ties to terrorism and extremism. CARE, the Council on Islamic American Islamic Relations, for example, has been consistently being accused of having ties to the Muslim Brotherhood, painting kind of this boogeyman. These candidates were accused of bringing Sharia, right? They have this awful agenda to take over the United States. We've seen this with even the two Muslim women candidates that did win seats in Congress, right? Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar. The barrage of attacks that they faced personally also as women. And so, unfortunately, just because you've had all these Muslim candidates that were running for offices, they weren't quite focused on their qualifications. Their criticisms didn't come because they had bad immigration policies or something of that sort, but it focused on what they looked like. How practicing were they? Do they wear the hijab and not? Are they going to bring Sharia? Are they going to respect the Constitution? You know, something that other candidates of color of different faiths don't usually face, unfortunately.
You mentioned Ilhan Omar as a target of some of that. She actually got elected to Congress from Minnesota last month, as you obviously know. But she was the target of one or more of these tactics, like falsely accusing her of having ties to terrorism, which you write about.
Right. Yeah. And other things like having a relationship with her brother and all these accusations that have been proven to be false. She has come out and said they were false. But again, it specifically ties to her Muslim identity. She's a Muslim woman. She's a Black Muslim woman. She's a Black Muslim woman who covers and wears the hijab. And so many experts say that she wouldn't have gone through or have faced all these attacks if she wasn't all those different identities.
Listeners, Muslim listeners, you get first priority on the phones during this segment for these next few minutes. Give us your own end of 2018 reports on Islamophobia 2 years into Trump, maybe we should call it, a year after the partial Muslim travel ban was approved by the Supreme Court. Anything you saw during the midterm election campaigns or anything else, 212-433-WNYC. Tell our Muslim and non-Muslim listeners alike your personal experiences. Are things settling down for you or your kids after maybe a spike in hate speech or intimidation or anything else directed toward you when Trump was first running or elected, as has been documented? Or is it getting more frequent even now, or whatever your experience is? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. How about women wearing a hijab or any kind of Muslim head covering? What's your experience like these days being so visibly identifiable, or anything else? First priority for Muslim listeners right now on the phones as we make sure some of your stories get heard at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. With Rueda Abdel Aziz, reporter at HuffPost, where she focuses on Islamophobia and social justice issues within the Muslim community. Before we get off campaign season tactics, there was this Harvard Kennedy School of Government study that you've referred to that identified the five most common tactics used to target Muslim candidates in the 2018 races. One that we've already talked about was claiming falsely that they have ties to terrorism. And one more from the Kennedy School list of tactics was targeting non-Muslim candidates who work alongside Muslim ones. Do you have an example of that or know how that goes?
Yeah, so this guilt by association is that folks had a friend that was Muslim or someone that they worked with. I think the most well-known, one of the most well-known Muslim activists, especially she's born and bred here in New York City, Linda Sarsour, is a great example of that. She is someone who has worked alongside different politicians, had worked on a number of campaigns, and she herself as a person faces so much hatred both online and in person. And people have said, you know, if you work with her, you have ties with her. She, again, is a proponent of Sharia. She's a Muslim, and therefore she's going to do things differently in the most awful and negative sense. So we've seen things of that sort, even with our current elected office, like Keith Elson, for example, who is a Muslim. Again, just the wave of Islamophobic attacks. If you know someone, you work with someone, and then you're just guilty by association.
And it reminds me of Pittsburgh, too, in a more extreme context, where the guy who staged the synagogue massacre had as one of his main grievances that the synagogue had been working to help settle Muslim refugees in this country. So just being nice to Muslims can get someone killed by an Islamophobe.
Right, which is terrifying. And it was also wonderful to see that such hatred isn't a majority in all sense. There was a fundraiser that came out immediately after by various Muslim groups that had raised over $200,000 for that particular synagogue. And so I think a message is being portrayed that these divisions won't divide specifically the Muslims in the Jewish communities. There's been a lot of interfaith work there. But there has been a lot of conspiracies online, such as, you know, the Muslim communities didn't give that money over to the synagogue, which has also been proven false. So there's this need to demonize the Muslim communities, even when they do something nice out of, you know, the goodness of their hearts, unfortunately.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're also live streaming video of the George H.W. Bush funeral, if you want to see that on our website at WNYC.org. Habib in Elmont, you're on WNYC. Hello, Habib.
Yes, good morning, Brian. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I would say I don't think that the Trump era has converted anybody to be a racist or more to react negatively against Muslims necessarily. I just think that it's exposed the folks who already had those latent ideas and just made it more comfortable an atmosphere for them to be racist or anti-Muslim.
To be more out in their expressions?
Yeah, just, you know, they feel more comfortable in making comments or just being more overtly anti-Muslim than they may have been in an atmosphere that's less chaotic and seemingly anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim.
You told our screener, I think, that your mother is from Pakistan. Is she experiencing anything like this that she talks to you about?
I mean, Brian, she's experienced things her whole life of living in, you know, in America. She's been here for, you know, 35 years. So I don't think that her experience has been overall negative, but sure, folks have said things to her at times, and but she doesn't really make that an issue. She's never made it an issue. She's never necessarily complained to me about it, but I know that she's had some experiences that I would characterize as uncomfortable, but nothing that I would say was either dangerous or, you know, a situation that she thought she had to leave, so...
Habib,
thankful for that.
And thank you very much for your call. Ozan in Levittown, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ozan.
Yes, hi, good afternoon. I'm a Turkish American Muslim. And as you probably know, in Turkey, we're very conflicted in regards to the hijab or / headscarf. It being, you know, we have more history involved in that and it being a political statement. However, here in the United States, it's a different situation, and Turkish Muslims are very proud of other Muslims, of course, taking office. But we're also proud of any Jews or any Black people or any Chinese or woman. Just that it's different from the status quo, and we all know what the status quo is when it's in regards to people that are different, Muslim like myself.
Ozan, thank you very much. On the hijab, obviously there are cultural differences, national differences within Islam, which is very diverse. I don't have to tell you. But you wrote an article this fall about Muslim women wearing a hijab facing road rage. Why did you single out road rage?
It was quite interesting, actually. So HuffPost is part of the Documenting Hate Project with ProPublica, which many media organizations are. And so I was actually going through the database and looking at tips when it came to the Muslim communities. And I have come across a number of tips of Muslim women who said who they were on the road. They were driving somewhere where there was something mundane, like going to school, picking up groceries on their way back to work, and have faced some sort of road rage. And oftentimes they were just like, oh, perhaps I forgot to put on my blinker or took a turn too fast or ran a yellow, just like most drivers would think. And then oftentimes than not, the situation escalated quickly. And then when a confrontation occurred, they were faced with racial abuse. They were called a terrorist, a raghead. One Muslim woman described to me that someone had put out his arm in the form of a Nazi salute while she was driving. And so I thought, well, if there's some tips in here, let me see how widespread of a problem this is. And I reached out to a number of Muslim women, particularly those who wear the hijab, and I was able to speak to 30 women on the record who have documented some sort of hate on the road while they were driving. And these were women who were comfortable talking to me. I know the number of women out there who didn't want to talk to me or didn't want to go public was probably much more. And so it was fascinating but also terrifying seeing the intersection of road rage and hate, because road rage is road rage. Everyone gets angry. You know, that happens. But what triggers someone to blame that person's ethnicity, for someone to bring in then a woman's hijab in this case, and then use that against her? And because these situations are so fast, a couple of minutes, sometimes not more than 30 seconds, oftentimes than not, these women aren't able to call the police or get a driver's license or a plate and to document. And so the statistics out there are non-existent, essentially. But it was something that these women say, hey, if I didn't have this on and I was just driving normally, don't think this would have been an issue. So I think it was a fascinating story to tell to remind folks who don't think about something as mundane as driving, you know, it's just something that's part of your daily life, can actually be terrifying to some Muslim women.
Let's take one more call, and from a non-Muslim listener, but I think he has a story to tell that's relevant. Phil in White Plains, you're on WNYC. Hi, Phil.
Yes, good morning, Brian. Yes, it was just coincidence that this morning I received I come from a fairly large family, you know, 13 kids, and, you know, we're all grown, et cetera, but I received an email from one of my brethren this morning. Very, you know, a successful, excuse me, college educated, you know, reasonably intelligent guy, and, you know, expanding on the fact that there's a national Muslim prayer day at the White House, and you know that, and then they go through all the little points about we're Sharia law and this and that, and you know these things come up, and this was not on Facebook. This was an email directed to me and to all of my other family members. So, you know, it's here, it's out there, and you know his second favorite thing is to you know send emails about Colin Kaepernick, and you know. These are things I just never knew I had a racist for a brother.
Did you respond?
It's everywhere.
Did you respond to him this morning, or do you intend to?
No, my response is normally the same, which is you should vet these issues and, you know, get some help.
Phil, thank you very much. You know, people who, I had an experience, Phil reminds me of it, a few years ago before the Trump era, I went to a minor league baseball game in Lakewood, New Jersey. And it was firefighters' night, where they had displays of firefighters with, I don't know, hoses, and they had trucks outside. People were celebrating the firefighters. And on the way out of the stadium, there was one firefighter standing by a truck, or at least it was a guy standing by a fire truck, holding a sign that said, everything I need to know about Islam, I learned on 9/11.
I've seen those, unfortunately.
And my wife, as soon as she saw it, went right over to the guy and gave him a piece of her mind. I was so proud of her. But I guess the question is, and the question that Phil's story raises is, how about when you're a bystander and maybe not even a Muslim, but you see something like this or hear something like this?
Yeah, I'm going to steal a line out of the Port Authority and say, if you see something, say something, right? And it's terrifying because oftentimes they're not, you know, Muslims want that. They want folks to say something. And, you know, I've heard stories where they feel more disheartened, where they're on a subway, for example, and someone is calling them a terrorist or using these racial slurs. And the majority of the time, the passengers on the subway are just kind of quiet and they don't stand up for them and they don't say much. And so the real issue is when we look at statistics, again, by the Pew that you mentioned earlier, more than half of Americans, it's like something around the lines of like 60-something percent of Americans don't personally know a Muslim. And so the only things that they do know about Muslims and Islam is from 9/11, right? Or is before that or after that? Are they seeing the plethora of negative stereotypes that Muslims are violent, that Muslim women are oppressed, that Muslims have ties to extremism or are more likely to become radicalized? And so when folks don't know a Muslim personally, these are the dominant images that are going to shape their perceptions. And there was another study that came right after that. Folks who did know a Muslim personally had just high praise. They were good neighbors. They worked with them. They were their colleagues at work, and it was just predominantly positive. So there's a huge, huge disparity between, you know, that guy who just stands out there with a sign. He probably doesn't, I highly doubt his neighbor is a Muslim, right? Or he's ever interacted with one, and probably is just reading things online, which is a dangerous place when it comes to information, particularly about Islam and Muslims. If you just Google Islam or Muslims, you're probably going to get some right-wing websites that have just peddled conspiracy theories and not actual and accurate information. And so sometimes you just really need to meet one, you know?
Rowayda Abdelaziz, reporter at HuffPost, where she focuses on Islamophobia and social justice issues within the Muslim community. Thank you so much for joining us
today. Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.